Welcome and breathe in air. Abstract Illusions Radio, the show that explores and exposes the many aspects of expression, with your host, Jennifer Hellman.
Everybody, this is Jennifer Hellman. I want to thank you for joining me tonight. We have a very special treat with our guest tonight. It is Ted Andrews. Ted Andrews has been called a Renaissance man, being an award-winning author, speaker, teacher, and storyteller. He has written over 35 books, a variety of subjects, from shamanic work, music, and he is best known for his work with animals, including two of my reference books, Animal Speaks and Animal Wise. I am really thrilled to be listening to a new CD version of Animal Speaks, which is now available. Welcome, Ted, to AIR. Thank you so much for being on today.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Just so everybody in the audience truly understands everything you do, can you give us a brief background of what everything you do?
In 25 words or less.
Well, I'll give you 30.
Oh, thanks. Everything I do, well, I am primarily a writer and a teacher, and I usually just consider myself more of a teacher because my books are just ways of teaching and passing on information and my own experiences. But I've been in this field quite by accident, but for close to 30 years now, working out there in the field doing various things, probably a little bit longer than that. Probably most known for my work with the animals and understanding their meaning and significance in their life. For nearly a quarter century, I've had both state and federal permits for working with birds of prey, hawks and owls, and I have my own hawks and owls that I use in educational programs throughout the year. Done a lot of rehab, a lot of educational aspects. For 10 years, I was a reading specialist in the public school system. So it's a wide and varied background.
It sounds like it. Now, you said by accident you got into this field. Would you like to elaborate?
Sure, because I've always been involved in this probably since I was a teenager, around 14 or 15. I taught myself how to erect astrological charts, doing the math and everything. And I always had a fascination with things that were mystical and spiritual, and it was a very big avocation of mine, but I never intended for it to actually become my way of making a living. And I left teaching after 10 years to write, but it was to write fiction and to do novels. And about a year and a half after I was out of teaching, I had a small novel contracted with a publisher. And so I was all excited about that. And at the time, I was doing some substitute teaching and also going and doing some lecturing in the metaphysical field just to kind of help make ends meet and have some extra money coming in. About 6 months before the novel was about to be released, the publishing company went bankrupt, and so it never came about. And at that time, I was teaching a lot of workshops and classes on Kabbalah. And so one of the things that I did, I thought, well, maybe what I would need to do is see if there's a publisher who would be interested in a nice, simple version of the Kabbalah. And I contacted a publisher and got a letter back that said, well, yeah, if you can simplify it, we want it. And from that led to my first book, which was called Simplified Magic, A Beginner's Guide to the New Age Kabbalah. And from that point on, it was pretty much out of my hands.
Yes. So do you still, I mean, you do workshops. I was very blessed in doing one of your workshops, actually in 2004. I can't believe it was that long ago. I mean, you're still doing a lot of different variety of workshops. Do you have a favorite, or do you focus most of your workshops on the animals for the most part now?
That's like asking me which book I like the best, because I do workshops on each of the books. And
yeah.
That's like asking a parent, which child do you like best? And that's a little bit difficult to do. Probably the most popular workshop, of course, is the Animal Speak, and that seems to be what I've become most known for in the last 10 15 years. But that's really not even my best-selling book. My best-selling books that have done much better than the Animal Speak are my how-tos, how to see and read the aura, how to work with spirit guides, things like that. And so those are always fun classes to teach because I'm very pragmatic and I like to show people how to do things for themselves so that they get away from this illusion that those that are working this field are gifted and special, but rather that it's something that anyone can learn to do and it has practical applications.
Well, I noticed on the CD you do give practical ways of connecting with the animal energies and understanding their involvement with us as well as us with them, which I
yes.
thought was very, very good.
Well, and you have to because people need to know that there's some practical application to this. It's what helps them to understand and to work with it and to implement it into their own normal daily lives. And when we do that, then it starts to become a powerful source for us to use to help ourselves in almost anything that we do.
Yes. Now, the questions I'm going to ask actually are from the audience. I asked them for the last couple months. As soon as you said yes, I started asking the audience to send me their questions because I want to make sure that their questions get answered. So the first question is actually about shape-shifting. They want to know the benefits of it and, briefly, if you can, some of the ways to connect with the animals.
Oh, good. And starting with the simple ones, are we?
Oh, yes.
There's actually different kinds of shape-shifting. We have this tendency to think that shape-shifting is a human becoming an animal or an animal becoming a human. And there may have been a time in which this kind of zoomorphism actually could take place when we were less substantial, less locked into the physical, you know, eons ago. I have never seen that actually demonstrated. I've seen a lot of people proclaim it. I've seen a lot of people demonstrate it that have been very poorly demonstrated as fakes, but I've never seen a legitimate demonstration of it. Doesn't mean that I don't believe it's not possible, because I think everything is possible at some point. But there's other aspects of shape-shifting. There is a process that is called personification, and this is where you do things to express the qualities and the characteristics of the animal. This is most often done through movement and dance. Almost every tradition on this planet had dances that imitated the movements of the animals, and it was a way of not only honoring the animals, but it was also a way of shifting your energies, because the human body is an absolutely magnificent mechanism. We are a biochemical electromagnetic energy system. We give off sound, light, electricity, magnetics, and thermal energies. We're a walking, talking, breathing energy system. When we move, when we dance, when we posture or gesture like an animal, we create an electrical change in our body that is similar to that of the animal, and it becomes easier to express that animal's qualities and characteristics. So, for example, if we needed to be more bear-like in a situation, we stand, posture, move, lumber like a bear. And as a result, it creates an electrical change that is very similar to the bear's energy, and it becomes easier to express those bear qualities. This is also part of shape-shifting. But shape-shifting is something that we do every day. We all change and adjust. We have a way of presenting ourselves in the work environment, what way of presenting and shifting our energies to present ourselves at the home environment. We learn to shift and to change, and it's something that is natural to us. We can learn to use it in tremendously beneficial ways. There's tremendous studies going on now taking a look at animals and the kinds of illnesses and diseases that they have as opposed to the kinds of illnesses and diseases that humans have. And they're studying animals that may not ever have a problem that some humans might with a particular disease, and they look at the biological rhythms, they look at the heart rhythms, the breathing rhythms, the entire metabolism. And then they expose the human to them, and they teach them to breathe a certain way. They expose them to drumming that's comparable to the similar heart rhythms. And it serves as a catalyst to help trigger a change in that person's condition or to help to create a shift. So there's tremendous applications to this on both a very individual level as well as more universal as well.
It's amazing that I was very blessed with doing a shamanic apprenticeship with a Native American, and I was able to really connect with a lot of the animals that are in part of my totems, and it was amazing. Bear was actually one of them, and I actually went hunting as a bear and had just felt like I was hiding away from humans and went out in the desert, because I live in Tucson, and looking for cactus fruit, and it was a quite interesting thing, but it also helped me understand the rhythm of my own body just going within and understanding what I'm about as well. Now, when you're doing this, and there is definitely a lot of benefits, how do you understand which animals that come into your life that you should pay attention to? Like in my front yard, I get lots of rabbits. And
exactly, and we have, this is one of the most common questions I get, that and something very similar is, you know, does every animal I see then, is that a messenger for me? And my response always is, every animal that you see or that you attend to or pay attention to is a messenger. It doesn't necessarily mean it's an individual, unique message for you. Sometimes that message is just generic, such as, look at how wonderful and diverse the world is around you, just as a reminder for that. If it is an animal, though, that is truly a messenger for you, there's two of the most common ways of identifying it. Is one is, does this animal show up frequently within my life, multiple times within a relatively short time frame? I often use the example, let's say, for example, that you're driving home from work one night and you drive through clouds of skunk spray. And you do that several nights during the week. You get home, you turn on Discovery Channel, there's a program on skunks. You flip the channel, there's Pepe Le Pew. You keep running into skunks. You open, go into a store, there's stuffed skunk toys everywhere. You're having multiple encounters all within a relatively short time frame. So if you encounter this animal in a variety of ways, whether it's through TV, actual experiences, but keep seeing it in various forms within 5 to 6 day period, that's saying, look, there's something here I need to be examining. The second way is if there's an unusual encounter with the animal. And the example I often use with people is, it's not unusual to hear an owl at night. They're nocturnal, that's when they are active, but it still is unusual to see one at night because they're very well camouflaged. They have a fringe on their feathers that allows them to fly relatively silent. But to see an owl in the daytime is very, very unusual. When you see an owl in the daytime, you're getting what I call a clue by four upside the head. It's saying, look, pay attention here. There's something very, very unusual, something you need to attend to. And so those are the two most common ways, is looking at multiple encounters within a relatively short time frame, and then looking for the unusual, the out of the ordinary kind of encounter as well. But at the same time, we need to realize that those animals that we see day in and day out in our own backyards, our own front yards, our own environment, also are messengers for us. These are animals that have learned to live successfully in the same environment in which you are living. And so there's something that they can teach you on how to live more successfully while you are sharing that environment.
Now my question is, lately the animal signs for me that I've been getting, actually I'm seeing two of everything. I actually saw two owls together. I've seen two coyotes. I've seen two falcons.
Well, the number of the animals that we see when we have an encounter does play some significance, and a little study of basic numerology will help you with that. You know, when you see two of something, they come in pairs. It might also be an indication that this is, since this seems to be the way that you're encountering animals, that this may be your own personal signal that this is an animal that is a messenger. When crows are a messenger for me, they always show up in threes. But that's that particular bird, and that's for me. For other people, it may be something else. But look at the significance of the two as well. You know, two is partnership. That's male and female. It's learning to work together. And all those numerological aspects associated with it will help you to understand that animal and that encounter a little bit more fully.
Okay. One of the questions also is related to that, and this person is asking, are there different totems within your totems relative to the different astrological influence of your birth chart? meaning your sun sign, your moon sign, rising sign?
You know, I haven't really done that much work with that. I would suspect there probably is, because we do always have more than one totem with us. We never just have one totem, because nothing exists in nature by itself. Everything is connected. And we may have what are called lifetime totems or power animals. We may have as many, depending upon what tradition you are associated with, as many as 9 that are with you off and on throughout your entire life. But you will also have other animals that will come in at periodic phases within your life just to help you accomplish a task, resolve an issue, overcome a problem, develop a skill, something along that that just may be there temporarily while these other power animals or lifetime totems are with you off and on throughout your entire life. But we always have more than one in our life, and it is because nothing exists in nature by itself. There's a process in nature called trophism. And trophism is the interconnectedness of all things in the natural world. The grass absorbs the sunlight. Grasshopper feeds off the grass. Frog eats a grasshopper. Snake eats a frog. Hawk eats a snake. Everything is tied to something else. Everything is connected. So you will always have more than one. So if you have, for example, a great horned owl as a totem, you probably also have the skunk, and that's because the skunk is the favorite food. What feeds upon the animal and what the animal feeds upon are also usually part of your totem combination.
Now, another question somebody asked is, what is the difference between a power totem, a birth totem, and a clan totem? Or is there?
What was the second one?
Birth totem is what she asked for.
I still didn't catch the first word on that.
Birth.
I'm having trouble hearing though. The phone's kind of...
Okay.
Well, let's start with the power totem.
Okay.
A power animal is anything that is pretty much with you off and on throughout your life. Most traditions taught that that animal totem that is with you is an animal that in some way reflects some aspect of your spirit. And so this is an animal that is going to be with you off and on through some development or through some aspect of your spirit and serve a particular function. Some totems may be there for protection. Some are there for teaching. Some are there to help us to open up to new realms. Some are there to help us accomplish tasks. And they are animals, the power animals are the ones that are with us off and on throughout our entire life. A clan totem is an animal that is more associated with the family. It is an animal that everyone in the family seems to have and works with family issues and things along that line. In my family, it's the crow, or at least on my mother's side of the family, it's the crow is very much the clan totem for our family.
And how do you figure out your clan totem? Other than, what? I mean...
There is no simple way. You almost have to do it individually, especially if you're not a Native American and tied into one of the clan groups. But one of the things is by talking with your brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers and aunts and uncles and ask them, you know, what animals have you most been drawn to, what animals. There's an old occult axiom, like attracts like. And those animals that resonate with us, that resonate with our family, are the ones that are drawn to us. And so on some level, everyone's going to have a similar connection to a particular animal. And sometimes you have to do some talking and some examination with other members of the family to figure that out.
Is there any way of using your tarot cards or animal tarot cards to figure that out? Can you do a reading?
Oh, sure. You can use, there's lots of other ways. You can work with dreams that can help you. You can also work, and there are specific meditations that you can do in order to help open that aspect up. You can use some of the animal tarots. I have the Animal Wise Tarot, but there are other animal decks that are out there that can help you with that as well also. And you can focus on that kind of clarification or on that particular issue or trying to figure out what that totem is for the family. And it's even fun because sometimes if you've got a family that's open to it, to do it with all members of the family and see what animals they get at, what similarities and what differences are. It also helps to liven up some family gatherings that might need it too.
Yes. Mentioning the cards, which I use, I think they're beautiful. I think they're awesome.
Thank you.
And I actually have most of your books as well. I just think you're an incredible teacher. I thank you for doing your work. with using those cards, there is ways within those to figure out exactly what your power totems are, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and then you can figure out some other things like what the animals are trying to tell you.
Right.
If you have these also in the other books, you can look up, if you see a consistent animal, that's a good way to figure out exactly what the message is with
right.
that animal.
Right. Okay. And there are different ways of finding out what your totems. You can use tarot cards. The simplest way, I always tell people, is to ask yourself some questions. What animal or animals have you most been drawn to your entire life? There's that old occult axiom again, like attracts
right.
like. And those animals that we've been drawn to our entire life are resonating with us for some particular reason, especially those animals you had a draw to as a child. And if you have children and you take them to a zoo or a nature center, what animal are they most excited about at the end of that visit? By studying a little bit about that animal, you get some tremendously unique insight into the individuality of that child. It gives you a whole different way of approaching them and working with them. You pay attention to your dream animals. Are there certain animals that you dream about more frequently than others? This will often provide a clue for you. Most traditions taught that dream animals are just as significant, just as important, just as real as if you had met them while you were awake, and we want to treat them that way. The nice thing about dream animals is that there's usually other elements within the dream scenario that will help us to understand what the meaning is or where this animal, what aspect of our life or area of our life this animal should be applied to.
Mm-hmm. Now, also, there are certain plants and trees that are associated with some of the animals, correct?
There are. I'm sorry, I missed that.
Trees, plants are also associated. So if you have an animal, you should also look at.
Yes,
the
you want to look to the environment in which this animal is normally found. You know, some animals are found around wetlands and marshlands. Some animals are found in woodlands. Some are more indigenous to meadows. Things along this like some to deserts, some to different various kinds of environments, as well as maybe even some specific plants, some specific trees as well. You know, we have a tendency to think that totems are just animals, especially within the Western world, but a totem technically is anything of the natural world that has meaning or significance for us. And that can be a plant, that can be a stone, that can be a tree. It's not just the animal. So if you have an animal, look to where the environment, what environment it is found, and look at the qualities and the characteristics. For example, those animals that are found naturally within marshlands and wetlands, these are areas of decomposition. There's a breaking down of old growth so that new growth can occur. So in some way, those animals normally found there are going to help us with the breaking down and some new growth in some area of our life. So taking a look then at the plant, at the qualities of that plant, that tree, that environment, will give you some further insight.
Is there anything else besides, is there ways of actually connecting with, say, a tree? Because in the CD, you mentioned that you talk to trees. I talk to trees. Is there any way of, that you can say that it will help you understand what the tree is saying? Or?
Oh, sure, absolutely. There's a lot of simple ways. Trees have, in the plant kingdom, trees, I think above all else, have tremendous affection for humans and are very open to us. We can look at trees from a botanical view. We can look at them from a mystical and a spiritual view, or a combination of all of them, which is often what I like to do. But I'm a firm believer in that it's always good to climb trees, and I'm pushing 60, and I'm still climbing trees. It's a great joy of mine. I love sitting up in a tree. I love the feel of it. You can sit underneath a tree, and you can meditate on it. You can just relax. Do what is often called in Confucianism, quiet sitting. You don't have to try and still the mind, but just sit underneath it and feel its energy. You know, everything, every plant, every animal has an energy, has an aura about it, electromagnetic field that surrounds it. And every tree has its own unique qualities and characteristics, even if we only look at it from an herbal aspect. You know, if you have aches and pains, go sit under a willow tree for 5 or 10 minutes. It will alleviate them. If we look at it from an herbal perspective, within willow bark is a chemical called salicylate, which is the basis of modern aspirin. If you have difficulty handling emotions, feelings of guilt, go sit under a pine, an evergreen, a spruce. It can be a wonderful way. It's very soothing, very calming to emotions and feelings of guilt. It's very balancing. And we can use that, and just sitting under them, being around them, is a wonderful way. I have a wonderful blue spruce in my front yard, and I'm often found sitting under it a half hour before my family visits and several hours afterwards, bless their hearts. But it's a tree that is just very comforting. And every tree has its own unique qualities and characteristics. Every animal has its own unique qualities and characteristics. And it's studying those qualities and those characteristics that helps us understand what the spirit of that tree, what the spirit of that animal can do for us. You know, the ancient shamans were scientists as well as mystics. They studied nature. They recognized that only by understanding the qualities and the characteristics of those animals or those plants that caught our attention, could we truly understand what their meaning was? It was the only way to avoid becoming superstitious about what they mean. And unfortunately, there's still a tendency to be superstitious, but if we do a little bit of studying, we begin to realize that that superstition starts to melt away, and we get a greater clarity as to what the meaning and the significance of that animal or that plant is. And for example, there's an old superstition about Valentine's Day that says that whatever bird you first encounter on Valentine's Day will all tell you who ultimately you are going to marry. If it's a blackbird or crow, it'll be someone who's a little bit serious, somber, maybe a little mystical. If it's a goldfinch, it'll be a wealthy individual. If it is a red bird, a cardinal, it'll be someone who's filled with vitality and sexuality. If it's a woodpecker, you're never getting married. Those are, of course, superstitions. They have nothing to do with the reality. But if we study certain aspects of those animals and of those plants, we can get a greater clarity as to what they mean, and that's when their accuracy as to understanding their application to our life really comes through, when we combine the science with the mysticism.
Well, in interpreting the animals, because some of them have many meanings to them, what is the best way to figure out which one really fits the situation? Is it just going by your intuition and what feels right about that
Sometimes
animal?
Sometimes you have to go by your intuition, but there's several things in particular I often recommend for people to do, that when that animal shows up and you go to try and figure out what it means, it's okay to look at the ancient myths and the tales about it, because that will provide some insight. But there's four things in particular you want to study about that animal. You know, you honor nature most when you study those aspects of it that come into our life. Because the more we know about that animal or that aspect of the natural world, the better it is to understand it, and then we have greater resources to apply it to what's going on in our life. And the first thing I often tell people is take a look, if this is an animal, at what its natural biological rhythm is. Every animal has its own unique biological rhythm. Times where it's more active, times where it's least active, times where it's more sexual and procreative, times where it's not. And that animal has shown up in your life, and part of the reason it has is to tell you that, look, this is the rhythm that is at play within your life right now. Use it. And if we do that, we save ourselves a lot of frustration, a lot of banging our heads against the wall, wondering why things aren't happening the way we want them to. So, for example, if you have bear showing up in your life, as bear late fall and winter approaches, they slow down their outer activities. They pull back into their den. It's during the winter months that the female bear gives birth to the cubs. It's usually 2, sometimes 3. In the spring, the cubs are brought out into the open. But the cubs will stay with the mother bear for up to 2 years before they go off on their own. So if you have bear showing up in your life, as late fall and winter approaches, slow down your outer activities. Pull back into your den a little bit. Focus on 2, maybe 3 projects. In the spring, bring them out into the open a little bit. But recognize it may take as much as 2 years before they actually mature and take off on their own. And if we realize that that's the rhythm at play within our life, we save ourselves a lot of frustration. When we put ourselves into the rhythm of nature, things unfold in the time and the manner and the means that is best for us. It doesn't mean we don't do anything, but we still do what we have to do, but we let nature take the rhythm for us, and everything gets empowered and unfolds more magnificently for us. The second thing to look at in regards to that animal is study some of its qualities and characteristics. Every animal has its own unique qualities. And that animal has shown up in your life to say, look, these qualities, these behaviors that I have are what are going to work for you right now. So, for example, if you look at something such as a desert fox, among members of the wild canine family, all foxes, but especially a desert fox, have very large ears, and this is a way of dissipating some of the excess body heat. You have trouble in handling the heat, brush the hair behind the ears. This is something that that animal does. A hawk that's sitting in a tree that misses capturing a rabbit, it doesn't pretend it's a weasel and chase it on foot. It has to learn to be true to its qualities, to fly faster, strike harder, grasp more intensely. That animal has shown up to say, look, these qualities that I have are the ones that will work for you right now. Take advantage of them. Use them. Because this is the time for it. And then the third thing to look at is take a look at how that animal adapts to survive in the wild. And every animal adapts to survive in the wild. And there are physical adaptations, there are behavioral adaptations. Something like a mule deer. A mule deer never follows the same path to a water source. It always alters it. Because it knows instinctively if it doesn't, it's going to end up as somebody's meal. It opens them up to predation. So if you have mule deer in your life, don't do the same thing in the same way twice. It won't work for you. Crows have a wonderful adaptation. If a bird of prey, a hawk, or particularly the great horned owl, which is their mortal enemy, comes into their territory, they will do what's called mobbing. They will gang up on it to drive it out of the environment because they know if they don't, that that owl is going to come back sometime in the night and have one or two of them for dinner. So if you have crows showing up in your life and you have some troubles, don't be trying to take them on yourself. Get some help. Get some assistance with it. This is an adaptation. And it tells us by looking at that animal's way it adapts, things that we can do to adapt and to change as well that will make things flow a little more fully, overcome problems, things along that line. And then the fourth thing to look at is take a look at that environment in which the animal lives. We talked a little bit about this just a bit ago. Every animal is indigenous to a particular kind of environment. And by studying that environment and the other animals that this animal shares the environment with will provide some insight on how to deal with other people that are sharing the same environment. Does this animal, are they antagonistic? Are they friendly? Are they cooperative? They just ignore each other. And it gives you some insight into your own relationships and things along that line. So take a look at those four things. And when we do that, then the lights, we start having all these little epiphanies. We begin to see where this animal might apply within our life. And the one thing I most recommend to people is when you have an encounter with an animal, especially if it's one of those extraordinary, unusual ones, take a look at what's most been on your mind in the last 3 hours, in the previous 3 hours to the encounter, and work your way back to the last 24. And it won't take you long, and you'll be able to pinpoint exactly where this animal is bringing you a message to handle something in your life.
Excellent advice. So I have a question from just out of curiosity. Bobcat, you're not supposed to mention that you've seen a bobcat because it's supposed to kind of lessen the power of the bobcat. Why is that? Is it just because they're all about secrets?
No, they're not only about secrets, but they lead a very secretive kind of life. They are very solitary. They are rarely seen. They know how to hide themselves very well. They know how to keep their homes and their dens in a way that's very secluded, out of the ordinary. And so when you've got an animal that is so secretive about that, this is an animal that knows then something about secrets and how to keep them and how to work with them and how to use that energy. This is an animal that has the ability to patrol the area in which it is living very silently, very quietly, and be aware of almost every change that's going on within it.
Okay. So it's, when you look in the environment and you see an animal that normally is not there, that's something that you really pay attention to then.
Yes.
Have you ever encountered, I want to say, a phantom animal that isn't usually in an area, yet you're seeing it?
Oh, sure. And this goes along with the idea that, yes, we can have totems that aren't found in this country. There are many people that may have an elephant as a totem. I think oftentimes something like this has to do with past life connections, past life issues, things along that line. It may be the animal, though, that even though it's not indigenous to this part of the world, is an animal that most reflects your energy, and so there's and your essence, and there's a draw to that. My sister is probably a prime example for that. She's a tiny little thing, but for many years she was an elephant trainer working with Disney's Animal Kingdom, as well as with a number of zoos. And she's very, very connected and has a tremendous love for elephants. This is one of her totems. But it's not an animal that you would normally find walking around the streets of Ohio, where we grew up. Just wasn't found in our backyards. But it can still be a totem because it's an animal that does reflect. And that's the universality of animals in essence, and that we are connected to everything in spite of distances and times and things along that line.
Do you find, because of the shifting consciousness that's going on right now, that more people are appreciating and wanting to connect with animals and nature? Are you seeing a greater demand for this information?
I don't necessarily think that it's a shifting consciousness that's causing that. I mean, that might be part of it. I think it also has to do with the fact that we're living it now in a society that has gotten, that has disconnected itself from nature, that in many ways, for many years, forgotten that it was part of nature, because we are part of nature, and everything that happens in the natural world has repercussions upon us, and everything that happens to us has repercussions upon the natural world. It's all connected, and no matter how much we cloak ourselves in civilization, we are still always going to be a part of nature. And so we're living in a society where people are not rural anymore. People are live in cities and in communities and suburbs. They don't have that connection with the natural world as much. And I think that there is, because we are part of nature, there is not only that draw to get back and reconnect, but it also has to do with the fact that there's always that consistency. You can't be in nature and not experience a sense of wonder, a sense of healing. It augments our intuition. And once people experience that and start to remember this, and I think this is probably one of the biggest reasons that my classes on the Animals Speak are often so filled with such a diverse group of people, not only males and females, but different ages as well. And it's because everyone has had some experience with animals, whether it's in dreams, whether it's in real life, with pets, with wild animals, in meditation. But everyone's had some kind of unusual experience with animals on some level. And so there's that common ground that is there. And so you see a greater diversity maybe in that workshop that I might be presenting, as opposed to not having that diversity in others, because nature is safe, it's balancing, and it is universal.
Now, with your classes, do you ever do like a mentorship with someone who really wants to be very much?
I haven't done that. I get a lot of requests for that. It's difficult with my schedule because with all the publishing and the recording and all the teaching. Excuse me. It's difficult to find time to do everything. You know, I haven't done private consultations in more than 10 years because I just ran out of time, and I'd much prefer teaching people how to do it for themselves rather than to have me do it for them. I am in the process, though, of developing an apprenticeship and teacher program. It probably won't be ready until 2009 at this particular point in order to do it the way that I ideally wanted to do it, which would include working with live animals, both domestic and wild. And to arrange that and incorporate that, there's a lot of preparation that has to be done with that. So that is going to happen at some particular point down the road here soon.
So what are you working on now? Are you mainly just promoting the CD that just came out, or are you writing some books now?
Oh, I'm always writing several books. Right now I've got a number of musical CDs that were put on audio cassettes, and I'm in the process of remastering them and putting them out in CD form. Also, I have a couple new books coming out next year. The first one is Healing Arts, which is part of my Young Person School of Magic and Mystery series. It's volume 7 in that. I have another book called The Intercession of Spirit, Working with Animals, Angels, and Ancestors. And that has a little bit more biographical or autobiographical information, but also gets more some new ways of learning to connect with spirit and how spirit, when we open our hearts to spirit, we do can create for ourselves a tremendously colorful world of wonder and life of wonder with around us at all times.
And
so those are the major things going on right now, but there's always something going on.
Are you teaching any workshops soon then?
I'm not going to be doing any touring or teaching now until March of next year. I'm taking a little bit longer break. For the last 15, 20 years, I've been doing anywhere from 50 to 100 appearances a year. And so I'm ready to take a little bit of a break. And so it will be March of next year before I do my next one, and that will be down in the Phoenix, Arizona area. People, if they're interested, I do keep a fairly current calendar of where I'm going to be on the DragonHawkPublishing.com website, www.DragonHawkPublishing.com. And so they can find out information there quite easily.
And you also have your books and audio CDs available there as well.
Yes, yes.
Excellent. So with all of these different areas that you study and you help people learn about, is it easy for you to intertwine all of them into your storytelling then? Because you are a wonderful storyteller.
Oh, thank you. It really does help, even though people say it's so many diverse things. To me, they're all very, very similar. They're so connected. You know, you can't look at animals without also looking at plants. You can't look at plants without getting into healing and herbs and things along that line. You can't look at healing and herbs without also looking at other forms of healing. For many years, I worked as a music therapist. And so I did a lot of things with music, and it is still the one area that I eventually always come back to just for my own well-being. Kabbalah entwines all of them, and so they're all very, very intimately connected. The things I do with my books, though, is I never write about anything that I can't do, that I can't demonstrate, or that I can't teach others to do as well also. And if I can't do those three things, then the book's not ready to be written. And that's how I usually approach things along that line.
Okay. So, and in your books, you do a lot of storytelling. And even on the CD for Animal Speak, you tell a story, several actually, that really help emphasize and help understand the connection between nature and animals, which I think is a great way of demonstrating it, and I appreciate.
Oh, well, thank you. Storytelling is just an absolute wonder. It's one of the oldest ways of teaching. You know, we can get an idea and get a message across through a story sometimes better than writing it out and putting it in front of a person's nose. Sometimes it takes the story. It's more entertaining. We relax, and we end up getting the message, and usually much more than what we thought we were going to do, whether we're telling the story or whether we're just listening to the story. There's a tremendous magic in storytelling, and it's one of the oldest forms of magic and mysticism and teaching that's been around on this planet as long as humans have been around.
Now, I'm going to ask you, what is your definition of magic?
That's very, very simple. If you trace the word back to its origin, it comes from the word meaning wisdom. And anything that helps to open up our wisdom, that makes us a little bit, to apply a little bit more wisdom within our life and to keep that wonder of life, is magical. You know, anything that adds to our wisdom, whether it's knowledge, whether it's intuition, if it adds to us being able to apply that knowledge in a way that is, makes us more creative and more productive in our life, then it's magical.
And was it Kabbalah that introduced you to the possibilities? Since you've mentioned Kabbalah, I would like to just touch on how you got introduced to it.
Kabbalah was interesting because my first two books were on it. The last book that I just released earlier this year, The Secret Doors of the Kabbalah, deals with an aspect of the Kabbalah that's never been written about. So it is an area that I've always been fascinated with. When I was a voracious reader, I'm still a voracious reader, and I especially always liked reading stories and tales and things along this line. And when I was in, I think in junior high school, 7th or 8th grade, I read a story about that took place during World War II in a prisoner of war camp, and it was about some Jewish men who created something called the Golem to help them escape from the prison, and it was done through something called the Kabbalah. And I read that story, and I was just absolutely fascinated with the word at that point. It just rang with me. It resonated with me. And I would look up anything that had a story that referenced it, I would read. And began to look for books on it. Of course, back then, there was nothing there because it was all held very, very exclusive. But any time I came across something that was associated with the Kabbalah, I would collect it. I would collect books on it, things along this line. I didn't understand them because most of the early books in the Kabbalah were either so esoteric that you couldn't understand them, or they assumed you already had a working knowledge, in which case, if you didn't, you couldn't understand it anyway. So it wasn't until I was doing my undergraduate work after high school, and my major was in ancient literature and linguistics, and so one of the things I did is I really began looking at the Kabbalah at that time and taking a look and trying to understand what it meant and how to apply it in a very practical, simple manner, which, as I mentioned earlier in this interview, that's what led ultimately to my very first book, which was Simplified Magic. And that book is still in print, and that's 20-some years ago that book was first released. So it's an area that I find tremendously satisfying because it's an area of mysticism that brings in numerology, astrology, tarot, animals, plants, mythology. It incorporates almost every aspect of what we consider the metaphysical and spiritual realm can be drawn in and applied and worked with through this simple diagram that's called the Tree of Life.
And it makes everything makes sense when you really understand the Kabbalah.
Yes. It helps you to pull things together.
Yes. It brings the science and the mysticism together, the spiritual together, that really helps understand what life is all about. It's a very interesting subject. I've done a little bit of reading myself on that. So from learning the Kabbalah and all the parts of it, and the Tree of Life, it made you kind of reach out to the individual parts, like the animals and the astrology, the numerology.
Well, the animals I'd always been associated with because I grew up from the time I was 6 in an area that was all farmlands and woodlands, and my grandfather, who had the ultimate green thumb and could make anything grow, and also was very connected to the spirit world, was a big influence and a big teacher in my life. The unfortunate and sad thing was he would never talk about anything very extensively. You just had to simply follow along and just kind of watch and observe and hopefully pick something up. But he was of that generation where you just didn't talk about these kind of things. But so there was always that connection to it. The music and the work with the healing came about because as a child, up until the time I was 12 years old, I was very, very ill most of the time. came close to dying several times, things along that line. Everyone usually wondered whether I was even going to make it into my adult years. So what I found, though, because I also had very, very bad asthma, is when I began practicing the piano and playing the piano, I found that while I was playing the piano, my breathing got better, and I would not have the trouble with asthma. And I began to see that connection between the sound and music and healing, and that was from the time I was 10 years old on, and I began to look and explore things associated with applying sound and then, of course, color and working with all these holistic modalities as I got older.
Excellent. And your wealth of information is available again. If you would like to give your website one more time, I want to make sure everybody can get the information.
It's www.dragonhawkpublishing.com.
And they are available there, but they are available at many other bookstores online and in the local area as well.
Yes.
Yes. Well, the time has come to an end, unfortunately. I could probably talk to you for another hour on so many different things, but I do want to thank Ted Andrews for being part of AIR. It has been a blessing to many people. I know you have helped me tremendously in my journey, and I will probably be seeing you in Phoenix in March.
Well, thank you.
That's not far from me. So with that, I want to thank the audience for listening, and with each breath of air, we hope you gain new insights and inspiration. This is Jennifer Hillman wishing you many blessings and a good night. Thank you.